So we're taking up in volume 11, at Louisa's prayer, Good Morning, Jesus. Okay, it's very good that you get this just before your break, so you have your good morning and your good night in place. Okay. What comes across is the extraordinary love that is between Louisa and Jesus. It's very personal, very intimate. O my Jesus, sweet prisoner of love, speaking to Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament, here I am before you again. I left you saying goodbye, and now I come back saying good morning. Close the front door.
Two ladies coming.
I was anxiously burning to see you again in this prison of love, to give you my yearning obsequies, she says. Now, obsequies are funeral rites.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Which is absolutely amazing. My affectionate heartbeats, my ardent desires, and all of myself in order to transfuse myself completely in you. Now, if she's offering him obsequies, is obviously a wrong word chosen by the translator. That she wants to die in him and for him. That's actually what she's talking about. I want to die in him and for him. What is it? Sorry?
Yearning, to give you my yearning regards.
Okay. And I want to abandon all of myself in you in perpetual memory and pledge of my love. Now, everything, as far as Louisa is concerned, is total gift of self, total, absolute gift. So, my beloved sacramental love, while I come to give you all of myself, I also have come to receive from you all of yourself, because that's what love is, a total giving on both sides. That's John 14, 20 to 21, you in me and I in you, both completely one. It's John 14, 20 to 21. I cannot live without a life, she says, and therefore I want yours. Now, when she says, I cannot live without a life, her old natural life is dead. She's already in divine will a long time. Okay, so the old natural life is dead. And she's living with the life of Christ, not with her own. And that is Galatians 2:20. I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me. Galatians 2:20. So she said, I have to have a life. So I want yours. All is given to one who gives all. Of course, there's the principle. Isn't it true, Jesus, she said. Therefore, today I will love with your heartbeat of a passionate lover. I will breathe with your panting breath in search of souls. I will desire your glory and the good of souls with your own immeasurable desires. All the heartbeats of people will flow within your divine heartbeat. We will grasp them all. And she can say we because there's only one will between them. We will save them. We will let nobody escape at the cost of any sacrifice, even if I should bear all the pain. Now, the way Louisa is praying there is the way Jesus prayed. In other words, that he would save souls at any cost to himself. Didn't matter what the cost was. So if it's at any cost to myself, you have the supreme act of love of neighbour. So Louisa has fulfilled the law of loving the neighbour right to the nth degree. If you should push me away, I will fling myself deeper inside. That's inside his heart and inside his will. I will cry out louder in order to plead together with you for the salvation of your children and my brothers. So now she's going to go on to a new bit, and she says that everything in divine will is souls and love, souls and love, souls and love. Because you hear me saying that the summary of the whole 36 volumes is divine will and love. And Louisa is adding a third one, that you would do anything to save souls. Oh, my Jesus, my life and my all, how many things does your voluntary imprisonment, now notice the voluntary, nobody asked him to lock himself up in tabernacles for the whole of human history. Absolutely nobody did it. And he has been telling Louisa now for 10 volumes that the suffering that is of real value to God is voluntary suffering. Okay, that's what the victim souls have. So your voluntary imprisonment tells me. But the emblem with which I see you all studied is the emblem of souls. In other words, this is why you do it. He's been telling us all the time that the motivation that we must have and the only one acceptable to him is love. Okay. But his emblem is souls. Everything is for souls because he is love. And the chains which bind you completely so very tightly are love. That's because God is love. So you can put 1 John 4, 7 to 17 there. God is love. 1 John 4, 7 to 17. It seems that the words souls and love, which you'd have to put in inverted commas because it's a statement. It seems that the words souls and love make you smile. They debilitate you and force you to surrender in everything. In other words, he'll pay any price for the salvation of souls. And I, pondering well these excesses of your love, she's talking about the Blessed Eucharist as one of the greatest excesses of God's love, will always be around you, together with you, with my usual refrains, souls and love, souls and love. Therefore, today, I want all of you, always together with me in the prayer, in the work, in the pleasures, in the displeasures, in the food, in the steps, in the sleep, in everything. So there you have the reason why we have the prayers telling us to offer absolutely everything for him. So Philippians 4:19 there. I'm certain that being unable to obtain anything by myself, which is John 15:5, with you I will obtain everything, which is Philippians 4:13. And everything we do will serve to soothe each of your pains, to sweeten every bitterness of yours, to repair for any offence, to repay you for everything, and impetrate any conversion, no matter how difficult and desperate. We will go begging for a little love from every heart. That's because you approach people from within. To make you more content and happy. Isn't it good like this, Jesus? She said. Okay. So, O dear prisoner of love, bind me with your chains, seal me with your divine love. Now, there's something that's extremely important for us, that we be sealed in the divine love. Now, many people trying to live a spiritual life, either in the ordinary sense or at the divine will level, if they're not sealed, you can fall back. Is that okay? So seal me with your divine love. Please show me your beautiful face. Oh, Jesus, how beautiful you are. Now, it's only the saints who actually know about this beauty. Remember Saint Augustine, O beauty so ancient and so new, late have I loved thee. That's one of the famous statements of Saint Augustine. And he's 4th century. How beautiful you are. Now that beauty, she isn't saying how handsome you are, because that's what you would say to a man, isn't it? Mm-hmm. She's saying beauty. And therefore she's talking about something that is internal, that's shining through the humanity. Okay? Your blonde hair, now she's completely sure that his hair is blonde. Maria Valtorta was sure that the hair was blonde as well. But in most pictures, you have him with brown hair. Yes. That's because people don't know. Yes. They're just simply guessing. Yes. Your blonde hair braids and sanctifies all my thoughts. Your forehead, calm and serene in the midst of so many offences, gives me peace and puts me in the most perfect calm, even in the midst of the greatest storms. Even of your very privations, of your whims, she said that a few times, which cost me my life. Now, beside all of that, I want to put Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 6. Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 6, in which the bride is describing the bridegroom, which is exactly what Louise is doing there. You know it, she said, but I move on. It is my heart that tells you this, for it knows how to say it better than I do. O love, your beautiful cerulean eyes, deep blue.
Azure. Azure.
Sorry?
Azure.
Well, cerulean eyes are blue.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's what the dictionary says. Sparkling with divine light, abduct me to heaven. Now, abduct me to heaven refers to all the times it pulls her into an out-of-the-body experience. And you make me forget the earth. But alas, to my greatest sorrow, my exile yet continues. Hurry, hurry, Jesus. Yes, you are beautiful, Jesus. I seem to see you in that tabernacle of love. The beauty and the majesty of your face enamors me and makes me see heaven. Your gracious mouth kisses me softly in every instant. Your gentle voice calls me and invites me to love at every moment. This is Song of Songs, chapter 5, verses 10 to 16. Your knees sustain me, your arms clasp me with indissoluble bond. I will impress my burning kisses thousands upon thousands upon your adorable face. Jesus, Jesus, may our will be one. This is the first time now she's talking about our will and we. That's very important. It's the beginning of volume 11. So may our will be one, may our love be one, and our contentment be one. I've just changed that into English for you, okay? Never leave me alone, for I am nothing, and the nothing cannot be without the all. So that's John 15, 5. Without me, you can do nothing. John 15, 5. So do you promise me, Jesus, she said. It seems that you say yes. And now bless me and bless everyone. And in the company of the angels, the saints, and your sweet mother, and of all creatures, I say to you, good morning, Jesus, good morning. Now, you have to be fairly far on to be that fervent very early in the morning. Isn't that absolutely incredible? So now she said, after I wrote these prayers, written above, under the influence of Jesus is what you need to colour. As he came at night time, Jesus showed me that he was keeping this goodbye and this good morning inside of his heart. Okay? And he told me, my daughter, they really came out of my heart. Whoever will recite them with the intention of being with me, as is expressed in these prayers, I will keep him with me and I will keep him in me to do what I do. Isn't that fantastic? I will not only warm him with my love, but each time that you would say the prayers, I will increase my love towards that soul, admitting him to union with the divine life and with my own desire to save all souls. So you need to put a little heading in front of that, and that's Jesus' promise. Because the next time you look at that page, then the title will invite you to read it. Okay. So the next paragraph is that we have to be all for Jesus. I would want Jesus in my mind, Jesus in my lips, Jesus in my heart. I would want to look only at Jesus, hear only Jesus, be clasped only with Jesus. I want to do everything together with Jesus. I want to love with Jesus, suffer with Jesus, play with Jesus, cry with Jesus, write with Jesus. Without Jesus, I don't even want to draw a breath. Isn't that fantastic? I will stay here like a fussy little girl doing nothing so that Jesus will come to do everything with me. Content to be his amusement, abandoning myself to his love, to his lashes, to his worries, to his loving whims, as long as I do everything with Jesus. You see, my Jesus, she said, this is my will. In other words, this prayer declares who I want to be and what I want to be. And you will not move me, she said. Do you hear? So come now and write with me, she says. How is that? So we have to say to him, come and eat with me, come and work with me, come and do everything with me. Okay. It makes a difference when you say, come and drive with me. He manages to order the rest of them as well as yourself and make the place an awful lot safer. And I always say to him, and would you ever protect us all from each other?
Yeah.
Huh? Absolutely. So February the 14th, 1912, Jesus looks at everything in the will. Now, what is most important to God? This is a very, very important teaching. We look at a marvellous building that somebody has built, and we say that the builder or the architect is great. And Jesus says, no, I don't look at the building. I want to know why they built it and who they built it for. It's what's in the will that's important for him. Because you see, you can't take the building to heaven. But you can take the love to heaven. And we have to keep this in mind all the time, that the baggage allowance for heaven only contains love. We have to keep this in mind, absolutely. And just the reason why I use that kind of language is that it is normal language for us, baggage allowance. Do you know what I mean? If you had said that 100 years ago, nobody would have known what you were talking about. So Louisa says, continue in my usual state. My beloved Jesus came and I was saying to him, tell me, Jesus, how is it that after you have disposed the soul to suffering and knowing the goodness contained in it, she loves suffering. She suffers almost with passion. And while she believes that suffering is her inheritance, all of a sudden you take this treasure away from her. Now, here's my suggestion. I don't think that came from Louisa. I think that came from the priests. And I think an awful lot of her questions came from the priests who needed to understand. Whereas Louisa is a very, very simple soul herself. And she would let the Lord do what he wants. You know that from the prayer we've just had. Okay. So this to me has to be a query that's coming from the priest. They want to know why she was suffering in an awful lot at an early stage. And now she appears to be suffering very little. So we're going to get a vital spiritual teaching here from the Lord. Jesus said, my daughter, number one, my love is great. Number two, my rule is insuperable, incapable of being overcome. Number three, my teachings are sublime. Number four, my instructions are divine, creative and inimitable. Now, I think if he was answering Louisa directly, just for herself, he wouldn't have used words like that. But if he's talking to the priests, he would. So he's going to go down through these four. Therefore, so that all things, be they great or small, painful or enjoyable, natural or spiritual, may acquire one single colour and of one single value, once the soul has practised suffering, watch this now, and reaches the point of loving it, which is where Louisa is at, I let this suffering pass into her will as her own property. Your will is your highest faculty. So, every time I send her suffering, having the property and the dispositions within her will, she will always be disposed to suffer and to love it. I look at things in the will, and it is as if the soul were always suffering. In other words, when all of this practice is over, Jesus shifts the reality onto a higher plane, and it's in the will. So whether you suffer or you don't, he said, as far as he's concerned, you are continuously doing it because it has shifted onto this higher plane where everything remains. Okay. And he said, I look at things in the will as if the soul were always suffering, even if she doesn't suffer. Now, if you remember St. Therese of Lisieux, she voluntarily locked herself up in a monastery for the short period of her life. Okay. When she had reached a certain level of union with God, she said to the Lord, I would like to be a priest and do all the work that priests do. I'd like to be a missionary and do all the work that missionaries do. I'd like to be this, that, the other. And the Lord said, done. You desire it, I do it. Isn't that amazing? We don't tell the Lord often enough what we would like to do. If you had the possibility, because I've often heard people say, well, I couldn't do that because I'm married and I have to stay here and I've got my family and I've got my duties to my family. But what they don't realise is that spiritually you can do it. Yes. Because he does it for you if you desire it truly. Right. And therefore, all the limitations of our lives are taken away. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? Yes. I'd love to be able to heal the sick. He says, if you really, sincerely, in the depths of your being, really, really want to do that, then he kicks in and he does it. Isn't it fantastic? It's just that we need to sort out what it is. Because people often say, you know, I'd love to do that, but there's no possibility at all of doing it. Because of my circumstances or whatever. And we don't realise that in the divine will, that limitation is removed. Isn't it amazing? So watch what we're going to do now. So every time I look at things in the will, and it is as if the soul were suffering, even if she doesn't suffer. And so that pleasure may have the same value as suffering, as well as praying, working, eating, sleeping, in sum, everything, because everything lies in whether things are from my will, so that all things may have the same value. I allow the soul to practice all things in my will with holy indifference, that it doesn't matter whether you're suffering or enjoying yourself. So it seems to the soul that I give her something and then I take it away from her, but it's actually not true. Rather, it happens that at the beginning, when the soul is not yet well trained, she feels sensitivity in suffering, in praying and in loving. But when through practice these things pass into her will as her own property, her sensitivity ceases. And the extraordinary thing is that at this very, very high level, you can be praying very intensely and there's no thought and there's no word. And you may appear to have no visions, no revelations, no nothing. You're just being there. But because everything has now lodged in your will, everything is happening. Am I making sense? Okay. It's terribly important. But people at a very early stage in the prayer life have all kinds of experiences of darkness and light and dryness and fervour and aridity and all kinds of stuff. That's when they're in training. And you take somebody much, much further on and they have usually a very tranquil experience where it appears as if there's nothing going on. Okay? If I give you this example, it's not a wonderful example, but in the very early stages of a relationship between a man and a woman, it's all very dramatic. But if you take them 40 years later, it's actually quite calm. But they've accomplished an enormous amount. And an awful lot can be said with no words. One of the things that really impressed me when I was a child, we lived in a tiny house, much smaller than this house, I can tell you. And we all had to fit in this one room. And so we had great order in the place because my dad had absolutely insisted on it. And he'd have all of us sitting around the table doing our homework. And my mother and himself would be sitting on either side of the fire in silence while this was going on, because he wouldn't allow any sound while we were trying to think. He absolutely wouldn't allow it. And then after a while, I'd look at the two of them and they were completely tranquil. Not a word, quite literally not a word being said. And I remember one night my mother suddenly getting up and saying, "I'll make you a cup of tea," which sounded good. My dad said, "Why did you spoil it? We were all one. The whole lot of us. We were all one in this silence." And that was a huge revelation for me. And as you can see, it never went out of my head. Yeah. Now, I was only primary school at the time. Sure. And my mother never, ever made that mistake again. She left us without a cup of tea. She realised that what was more precious was this unity that we had in silence. Now, the only time the silence was broken, if one of us got completely stuck, and we usually turned to the dad to solve the problem. But it's this kind of thing that we need to look at the fact that when a relationship is mature, it doesn't need all the words. Am I talking language? Yeah. It doesn't need all the words. It actually doesn't need all the drama. At the beginning, you're building the relationship. You're trying to find out who you want to be and where you want to go and so on. Now, it's the same thing spiritually as well. And therefore, people at a very early stage in the prayer life need an awful lot of help with prayer. And they think it's all over when they get their first aridity, and I always laugh. I say, you mean you got your first Monday morning? There's lots more Monday mornings coming. So her sensitivity ceases. Okay. And when the need arises for her to use these divine properties, which I made her acquire, with firm step and imperturbable heart, she begins to exercise them as the opportunity comes. In other words, if Jesus asks Louisa to carry some suffering, she says, yes, it's no big deal. But what she's got to do now is be just as tranquil when he doesn't give it to her, because he's going to move her away completely from that into a new vocation altogether. For example, does suffering come? She finds within herself the strength and the life of suffering. Does she pray? She finds within herself the life of prayer, and so with all the rest. So we now get an explanation in the next paragraph. According to what Jesus says, Louisa says, it seems to me it's like this. Let us suppose that I have received a gift. Until I make up my mind on where I should keep that gift, I look at it, I appreciate it, I feel a certain sensitivity in loving that gift. But if I keep it under lock and key, no longer watching it, the sensitivity ceases. What the eye don't see, the heart don't feel. Okay. However, with this, I cannot say that the gift is no longer mine. On the contrary, it most certainly is mine, because I keep it under lock and key. While before it was in danger and someone might have stolen it from me. So isn't that interesting? What's happening now is that you're not actually looking at it. You're not examining it. You're not saying, am I in aridity or am I in fervour? Am I this, am I that? The concentration's gone completely off yourself and you're only looking at the Lord. So Jesus then continues, in my will, all things are in balance. I'm trying to put English on what I'm looking at. All things are in balance. And he's going to tell us from here on in that everything inside of us must be balanced. Anger is one of the very powerful emotions that we have, and it can get out of balance quickly. But if anger and all the other responses that we have are balanced with each other, you'll use anger correctly. Because sometimes it is actually necessary to say something strong and powerful to another person. Do you know what I mean? So that there's real power behind what you're saying. There's a way of saying no and everybody knows it's no. And there's a way of saying no in which everybody knows you're up for negotiation. Or that you actually don't mean it at all. And so using anger correctly is really powerful, because when you want to say no strongly, everybody hears it. And then there's no need for any more conversation. Everything has to be in balance. We are on volume 11. And in the early volumes, Jesus had spoken about someone who is fervent one day and is not even interested another day, who'll pray one time and they're not interested, or they'll do good and they're not interested. That life is out of balance. Or a person who is married and has a family and spends all their time in stuff, no matter even if it's good, outside the family, that's not balance. Because there's no balance in the commitment. Is that okay? And the so-called good works can just be an escape instead of facing thing. So everything has to be in balance. So as we go forward from here, everything has to be in order and it has to be balanced, just like it is in God himself. So they all look alike and all in accord. Now he's talking about all the virtues, everything must be in balance. Therefore, suffering gives its place to pleasure. Now, if you talk to someone in the early stages of the spiritual life, that's a contradiction in terms. They think there must be no pleasure at all. You know what I mean? People who just do not understand God will say that. People who have had great experience of God knows that God is the author of everything. And if God has given us the ability to enjoy something and you absolutely refuse to use it, well, it's the same thing as refusing to use anything else. So it must be balanced. So someone who only wants suffering, that's completely out of balance. So in the volumes leading up to here, you've seen that when Jesus would ask a lot of suffering of Louisa, he would be with her the whole time. He'd never leave her. He was strengthening her. He was encouraging her and empowering her all the time. And then afterwards, they would have these very fervent moments of pouring love out to each other. And the two were balanced. It's actually terribly important. Okay. So everything has got to be in balance. Therefore, suffering gives its place to love. That's it's a pleasure. I've done my part in the will of God. Now you do yours. And only if Jesus wants it, I will enter into the field again. Number two, fervor says to coldness, you will be more ardent than me if you content yourself in staying in the will of God in my eternal love. Prayer will give way to work, sleep to vigil, illness to health, everything. In other words, everything is in balance. You're not absolutely putting one thing over all the others. And what's the one thing that holds them all together? It's the divine will. And if it's in the divine will, Jesus says prayer has the same value as work, sleep has the same value as vigil, suffering the same value as pleasure, everything. Okay. So all things among themselves, it seems that each one leaves its place to the other to be present in the field. Though each one has its own distinct place as well. So it's not necessary for one who lives in my will to move in order to place herself in the act of doing what I want. In other words, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to do any special ritual. She's already in me like an electric wire doing whatever I want. Now, one of the things I love about him is that as soon as an invention has come on board, he takes it on board. So if your house is wired for electricity, you leave it wired. You don't actually unwire it. You just do it once. And he says, you get into my will, do it once, it balances everything. But I love the fact here, because you won't find this in many spiritual writings, that pleasure and suffering have the same value. There are many people who think that if you take coffee and a biscuit in Lent, that there's something really wrong with you, that you really are failing God. Now, I'm deliberately using that example because everybody says, oh, biscuits in Lent. You know what I mean? As if there was something about biscuits and Lent. There isn't. There's no connection between biscuits and Lent. None whatsoever. Between Lent and self-denial, yes. Between Lent and mortification, yes. But between biscuits and Lent, no. But we can make a connection like that and it can even turn into a judgment of another person, you know. So February the 2nd, 1912. I don't know what date it is. It's February anyway. The offering of a victim. Continue in my usual state, my adorable Jesus made himself seen crucified with the soul near him who was offering herself to Jesus as a victim. And Jesus said, and this is very important because some people, I've actually come across people who've offered themselves to God as a victim, and I say, are you absolutely certain that you know what you're doing? Because I think it's just a moment of fervor, and they have no idea that the consequences would be drastic. Okay, so Jesus now talks to this person who wants to offer herself as a victim. My daughter, I accept you as a victim of pain. That means if she's a victim of pain, she's going to have that for the rest of her days. Everything you may suffer, you will suffer as if you were with me on the cross. Well, if you're not ready for that, you don't make the offering. And with your sufferings, you will relieve me. Many times, this relieving of me with your sufferings escapes you, he said, because she's not ready for this. Know, however, that I was a peaceful victim and host. So if I offer myself to the Lord and accept to be a victim of pain. And all of a sudden, I'm wondering why I'm getting all these headaches and why my back is killing me and why I can't walk and all the rest of it. And I have all this pain and I start getting depressed and upset. Am I ready? No. He said you have to be a peaceful one. In other words, you have to be ready for this. So you don't make an offering like that unless you're ready. Because you've heard me say before, don't say to God what you're not ready to actually do. He said, I don't want you an oppressed victim. In other words, you start getting depressed because of all the pain. That means you're not ready for this. Because you see how much Louisa has suffered and has agreed to suffer, but it never caused her depression and it never made her unpeaceful. He said, I want you peaceful and joyful. I want you to be like a docile little lamb with your bleating, that is your prayers, your sufferings and your works. And it will serve to soothe my embittered wounds. Okay. So a person who's offering themselves, therefore, must be peaceful and joyful. Okay. I want to give you 2 Corinthians 9:7 there. 2 Corinthians 9:7 says, God loves a cheerful giver. Okay. And one of the things that reading any of the saints, they will tell you, that God does not want a sour saint. As far as he's concerned, you're not in the school if the sourness is there, because the sourness is not part of the kingdom of God. So February the 18th, how a soul who lives out of the life of Jesus can say that her life is ended. That's your Galatians 2:20 there. I no longer live. Finding myself in my usual state, my always and all lovable Jesus came and he told me, my daughter, everything you do for me, even a breath, enters into me as a pledge of your love for me. Now, even a breath, even a movement. And I, in exchange, give you my pledges of love. Therefore, the soul can say, I live from the pledges of my beloved, that my beloved Jesus gives me. Okay. So, to use language which we'll have a little bit further on, Jesus has bilocated himself into Louisa. He says, I'm living my actual life in you. Okay. He's living his own life on earth through Louisa. And he's continuing his own mission to save souls and to suffer and to die and to rise again, to continue redemption. That's the very special thing that's going on between Jesus and Louisa and what he wants to do with us as well. Quite literally, bilocate himself in us. Then he added, my beloved daughter, since you live from my life, it can be said that your life is ended, that you no longer live. Now, quite literally, that's a quotation from Galatians 2:20. So, since it is no longer you who lives, but I, anything they do, they are the priests, the people who are guiding Louisa, anything they do to you, pleasing or displeasing, I receive as if it were done directly to me. Acts 9:5. Saul, you are persecuting me. Matthew 25:40. Whatever you do to the least of my brethren is done to me. Do you remember? So whatever the priests do to you, pleasing or displeasing, I receive as if it was done directly to me. And you can understand from this, from the fact that whatever the priests do to you, whether pleasing or displeasing, you don't feel anything. Now, the fact that she doesn't feel anything doesn't mean that her senses are dead. It means that there has been a genuine exchange of life. Jesus is actually living his life in her. And therefore, the sensitivity that we would normally have to these external stimuli, Jesus has picked it up. Isn't that absolutely incredible? This is why she can live in ecstasy most of the time. When she continuously says, I was in my usual state, she's in an ecstatic state. And in an ecstatic state, you don't feel external stimuli. This means that there must be someone else who feels that pleasure or displeasure. And who else could feel it if not myself, who lives in you and loves you very, very much? That means he has bilocated himself into Louisa. It's an absolutely extraordinary thing. This is the first time in history that it has happened to somebody who was born with original sin. So, February the 24th, 1912, the soul who lives in the divine will loses her temperament. That's her characteristic way of doing things, and acquires that of Jesus. Now, in the past, we used to say of people, they have become very Christ-like. That means you've acquired the characteristics of Christ. That's what he's talking about here. Notice I said in the past, unfortunately. After I saw various souls around Jesus, especially one who was more sensitive, you see? Now, more sensitive means that at an earlier stage. He said, my daughter, if the souls with a sensitive temperament start doing good, they make more progress than the others because their sensitivity leads them to arduous and great enterprises. Now, a very sensitive person is guaranteed to suffer hugely, because everything affects them at a level that it doesn't affect other people. But if they turn that all over to the Lord, they have the potential to become great saints. Whereas a person who doesn't feel like that hasn't got the same stimulus. So Louisa said, I prayed that he would take what was left of her human sensitivity away from that soul, and that he would clasp her more closely to himself and tell her that he loved her, for he would conquer her completely, and she would hear that he loved her. You'll see that you will succeed, Louisa said. Have you not conquered me in this way, telling me that you love me very, very much? And Jesus said, ah, yeah, yeah, I'll do it. But I want her cooperation, you know. That she escape as much as she can from the people who excite her sensitivity. If you have a colouring thing, colour it. In other words, if you really want the Lord to take over, you've got to escape the people who are driving you mad and therefore keeping you all the time in crisis. The people who excite her sensitivity. Now, when I read that first, I remembered a statement from Thomas A. Kempis. What was the Imitation of Christ? Do you remember? It's the only bit I remember out of the entire book. And it said, when I go out among men, I come back less a man. In other words, you go into a crowd and you've got all the problems that are in that crowd and all the multiple motivations and all the rest of it. If you want to live a prayer life, you mustn't expose yourself too much to the crowd. You must learn how to stay on the path that you're on. I think that's very interesting. I want her cooperation, that she escape as much as she can from the people who excite her sensitivity, and therefore that her sensitivity is more exposed to what God can do with her. So Louisa added, my love, tell me, what about my temperament? What is it? I love this now. It's a very good response. Jesus said, one who lives in my will, which is Louisa, loses her temperament and acquires mine. So you may start out as a very sensitive person. That's not where you're going to end. So in the soul who lives in my will, one finds a pleasant, attractive, penetrating, dignified temperament, and simple at the same time, of a childlike simplicity. In some, it's like me in everything. First of all, I want to give you Matthew 18, verses 1 to 3. I want you to become like little children. Now, look at the list that the Lord gives us there. A pleasant temperament. Now, the pleasant temperament is not giving you the bad weather forecast all the time. Do you know what I mean? And it's not over sunny either. It's pleasant. It's balanced. Attractive. It draws people to itself. If you read the gospel, children were very attracted to Jesus. And children are pretty good at sounding out adults, whether they like them or not. Penetrating. It's very, very deep. It's dignified. That's very wonderful. He said, looks like me in everything. Even more, she keeps her own temperament within her power as she wants and as it is needed. Now, the fact that his temperament takes over doesn't mean that yours dies. It means that yours is in the background and his is in the foreground. In other words, we're free. Everything that he tells us, we're free. And the difference between the way God deals with us and Satan deals with us is that Satan takes your freedom away. If you let him in at all, if you let him in on any particular area, he will take it over. Like if you take someone now with a problem with anger, and they are showing this wrong anger a lot of the time, Satan comes in on it and makes it worse, and gradually they reach a point where they have less and less and less power over the anger. If you put that anger into the Lord's hands, what happens is that you gain more and more and more and more control over the anger. But your will is completely free, whereas Satan uses the anger to make your will weaker and weaker and weaker until you have no control. It's just very important to see how the two work. Because in dealing with people, you'll see this in their lives and you'll be able to give them advice, you know. So we're always free. But since she lives in my will, she takes part in my power. So she has all things and herself at her disposal, and according to the circumstances and the people she deals with, she takes my temperament and applies it. So, for example, you meet somebody who is happens to be a difficult person for you, mm-hmm. and that person would draw out maybe the worst out of you. Mm-hmm. If you're living in the divine will, you can call on Jesus' temperament to deal with that person. Okay, so I want to give you 2 Corinthians 6:10. As having nothing, we actually possess everything. 2 Corinthians 6:10. So Louisa said, tell me, will you give me a first place in your will? Now that should remind you of two young gentlemen who got their mother to ask Jesus, can we be first in your kingdom? And he said, you don't know what you're asking. And the strange thing, I never thought Louisa would actually ask him. And he smiled and he said, yes, I promise you. Because the answer to the question of James and John, Jesus said, no, my Father is the one who determines who's on the right and on the left. And the extraordinary thing is you discover in these writings that the person on the right is Blessed Mother, who brought redemption to the world by bringing Jesus into the world. And the one on the left is Louisa, who brought the divine will down to the world. And that's not, would have been anywhere on the radar of those two lads. Okay. Things aren't just not what they seem. So Jesus said, yes, I promise you, I will never let you go out of my will, and you will take and do whatever you want. And Louisa said, Jesus, I want to be poor, little. I want nothing, even of your own very things. Now, there's something very, very unusual, because if you've been in charismatic prayer groups, they want all kinds of gifts. They want ministries. They want this. They want that. They want the other. They want leadership. They want, which tells you that they're at an early stage. And here's Louisa saying, I want nothing but yourself. It is better if you keep them, she said. I want only you. And as I need things, you will give them to me. Isn't it true? And Jesus said, bravo, my daughter. Finally, I have found someone who doesn't actually want anything. Because most people go to God with a shopping list. Everyone wants something from me, she said, but they don't want all. They don't want me for myself alone. Now, we all know the pain of somebody wanting stuff from you, but not actually wanting you. Mm-hmm. And we all find that a great pain, that somebody finds it useful to be near you, or useful to be connected to you, or useful to use your name or whatever. And all of that is agony. Every single person wants to be loved just for themselves. Okay. And you see that loving a person just for themselves in the love that's given to an infant. The infant can't give you anything back except a smile. And then they learn how to give you love. And the amazing thing is you love them just for being who they are. Okay. So Jesus said, everyone wants something from me, but not the all. That is for myself alone. But you, by wanting nothing, have wanted everything. And here is all the fineness and the astuteness of true love. That by wanting God for himself alone, she actually receives everything, including the kingdom of the divine will. So you can put beside that, God alone sufficeth. God alone. S-U-F-F-I-C-I-T-H is the exact words of Teresa of Avila. 16th century. God alone suffices. Nothing else. When we get to that stage, you'll be amazingly free and happy. So February the 26th, 1912, this is about love, because the summary of the 36 volumes is Divine Will and Love. So we have to keep coming back to love. My daughter, I am love. Now, if you remember back to volume 1 and 2, I am faith, I am hope, I am charity, I am patience, I am obedience. Here he says, I am love. And I made my children all love. Their nerves, bones, flesh are woven with love. And after I wove them with love, I made blood flow in all of their particles, as though covering them with a garment in order to give them the life of love. So, the human creature is nothing other than a complex of love. And she does not move other than out of love. We know that, don't we? It's love that makes the world go round. And everything's impossible if there's no love in it. Marriage is impossible without love. Everything's impossible without love. At the most, there can be varieties of love, but it's always out of love that she moves. Watch this now, because the love can go astray, can't it? Mm-hmm. There can be divine love. There can be love of self. There can be love of creatures. There can be evil love, but always love. Nor can she do otherwise, because her life is love, created by the eternal love and therefore led by love as by an irresistible force. So, after all, even in evil, even in sin, there must be love. Isn't that absolutely amazing? Mm-hmm. What he means is love of money, love of power, love of pleasure, love of myself, whatever, but it's love of. He said, even in sin, there has to be love that pushed the creature to do that evil. Isn't it amazing? Mm-hmm. So, ah, my daughter, what is not my sorrow in seeing the human creatures, the property of my love, which I delivered, being profaned and contaminated by a different use? Now, that's like saying that you gave a most incredible gift to somebody and you see them using it in the most base way. Do you know what I mean? They just throw it there and they use the gift as if it had no value, and they're using it in such a way as to insult the giver. That's what he's saying. In order to guard this love which came out of me and which I gave to them, I remain around them like a poor beggar. And as the person moves, palpitates, breathes, works, speaks, walks, I go begging for everything from her. And I beg her, I implore her, I beseech her to give everything to me, saying to her, daughter, I ask from you nothing other than what I gave you. It is for your own good. Do not steal from me what is mine. Your very breath is mine. That's Genesis 2:7. Genesis 2:7. Your very breath is mine. Breathe only for me. Your heartbeat and movement are mine. Palpitate and move only for me. and so with all the rest. And to my greatest sorrow, I'm forced to see the heartbeat taking one way and the breath another. And I, poor beggar, remain on an empty stomach, while the love of self, the love of creatures, the love of passions remain full. That's the wrong use. It's very interesting, isn't it? So the Lord is saying there, in very flowery language, actually, that if we don't hand ourselves over completely to him, we're in danger of the whole thing going awry. And he said, can there be a greater wrong to God and to ourselves than this? My daughter, I want to pour out my love and my sorrow with you. Now, with you means the victim soul. Only one who loves me can compassionate me. Now, when he says one who loves me, in these writings, he's usually talking about the victim soul who loves to the point of suffering for others. So, February the 28th, 1912, we're going to have discernment. Okay. This morning, as my adorable Jesus came, I said to him, "Oh, my heart, my life and my all, how can one know whether one loves you only or others also?" And this is a very important question. How do I know I actually love God? And how do I know if I love him all by himself? So the next paragraph is true love for Jesus. It's the answer to it. It's true love for Jesus. My daughter, if the soul is completely filled with me up to the brim, to the point of overflowing outside, that is, if she thinks of me, searches for me, speaks about me, and loves nothing but me, it seems that everything else does not exist for her. Rather, it bores and it bothers her. At the most, she gives the scraps, the last place to that which is not God, as if it were her last thought, word, or act for a necessary thing of the human life. So the very first thing he says is, if God is the very centre of everything you do, yes, you're there. So that's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. You love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your being. Okay. And the scraps to human nature means that, yeah, you've got to take care of your body. You've got to look after stuff. Do you know what I mean? But you're not doing it as the central thing. Everything is concentrated on God. But if you have to go to the dentist, you go. And if you have to go to the doctor, you go. Do you know what I mean? But it's not central. It's what your relationship with God that's central. This is what the saints do, is what Jesus said. So it means that the primary focus is on the Lord. I did it too with myself and with the apostles, giving some dispositions on where to spend the night and what to eat. Giving this to one's nature does no harm either to love or to true sanctity, but it is a sign that the creature loves me only. So in other words, you look after your body and you look after your life, but that's not the centre. And the centre, the focus is actually God. Now, in the next paragraph, he'll always give you the negative after the positive. So in the next paragraph, we have the problem of a divided heart. And I want to give you some references for a divided heart. Isaiah 1, 5. Isaiah 1, 5 and 6, 10. And Jeremiah 17, 10. 17, 10. And Hosea 10, 2. Hosea 10, 2. Now, the prophets of Israel have an awful lot to say about the divided heart. But if the soul alternates among various things, the Lord said, at one time she thinks of me and then of something else, or she speaks about me and then she speaks at length about something else, and so with all the rest, it's a sign that she doesn't love me only, and I'm not content with it. So what he's saying here is that you give some attention to the Lord and you give lots of attention to other things besides. Then, if only her last thought, her last word, and her last act is for me, it's a sign that she does not love me. Her last word, last thought, and last, I think, is best illustrated this way. It's an Irish joke, and it's about two women who come out in the morning and greet one another, and one says to the other, "How's your mother?" And the other one says, "Oh, we got the priest for her last night." And the first one says, "Oh, I didn't think she was that bad." You don't need a priest and you don't need God unless she's on her last breath. That's what's being illustrated here. That God is not in the centre of that life. It's only what I call hellfire insurance. Yeah, exactly. So it's the last thought, the last word and the last act. In other words, God is last, he's not first. It's a sign that she doesn't love me. And if she gives me anything at all, she gives me nothing but scraps. Yet this is what most people do. That bit you need to colour. And very particularly if you think of people who turn up for Hatch, Match and Dispatch. They're not giving much to God, are they? "Ah, my daughter, those who love me are united with me like the branches united to the trunk of a tree." John 15, verses 1 to 10. "I am the vine and you are my branches." John 15, verses 1 to 10. Can there ever be separation, oblivion, or different nourishment between the branches and the trunk? Their life is one, their purpose is one, and the fruits are the same. Even more, the trunk is the life of the branches, and the branches are the glory of the trunk. So I want to give you Galatians 5:22 for the fruits. It's the fruits of the Spirit, you see. And if you take the image of the vine and the branches, it's the sap that produces this life. Okay. I love the fact that the branches are the glory of the trunk. There was a story told about Gandhi at one stage. They asked him... why wouldn't he become a Christian? I can't give you the whole lot, okay? And he said, "I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians." He said, your Christ is fine. I have no problem with your Christ. And I've come across that with other Hindus as well. I like your Christ, I don't like your Christians. In other words, we're not producing the fruits that make other people want to take them. You see, so The branches are the glory of the trunk. Another way that is illustrated is using an image now from John chapter 10. And that is that in Israel at the time of Christ, shepherds looked after the sheep of all the farmers around. They didn't look after sheep belonging to themselves because sheep had to travel quite long distances to be fed. So if the sheep were healthy and woolly and fat and all the rest of it, they said it was a good shepherd. Right. But if the sheep were scrawny and didn't look healthy and all the rest, they said he was a bad shepherd. So the sheep were the fruits of the work of the shepherd.
Right.
They actually advertised who the shepherd was. Yeah. So the branches are the glory of the trunk. Okay. And if we can say that too, "Oh, the apples were great this year." You see, the fruits were good. Okay. So this is how souls who love me are with me, he said. Now, notice we're getting a good deal of discernment and sorting out before we get into the deep stuff. It's very interesting how he does it. This is all preparation stuff. Okay. So March the 3rd, 1912, the temperament of Jesus is formed by his will. In other words, if Jesus' temperament is to be shown in me, how will it happen? Everything happens in his will, okay? And he's going to be, you remember we were talking about balance a few minutes ago? Now we're coming back to it. He's just going to use a different word, harmony or music. Jesus said, "My daughter, one who does my will loses her temperament and acquires mine." See, we've already been told that. In your head, you'd say, how can this happen? "And since in my temperament there are many melodies which form the paradise of the blessed, such that music is my sweet temperament, music the goodness, music the sanctity, music the beauty, music the power, music the wisdom, music the immensity, and so on with the rest of my being. Why are they using the word music? They mean harmony. Everything is an absolute harmony. Okay. Now, anybody who's had an anyone who's had a death experience can have experienced the harmony that's in heaven. I've experienced it because I had a death experience. And I remember hearing the harmony of the angels. And it was so incredible that I can't listen to music. Because to me, it's not harmonious by comparison to what I heard. It's like as if you had 100 or 1,000 orchestras all together in harmony. And yet you had millions of voices all together in harmony. And, you know, we have our scales, but they had dozens of scales up and down. There seemed to be no limit to how high you could go or how low you could go. And it was mesmerising. Mesmerising. So the only music I can personally tolerate is the very, very best of classical. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I can't take it. Because I hear the disharmony.
Well, Pavarotti, and he was supposed to hit the high C note so frequently. This high C, I don't know much about music, but it seemed to be a very high note that very few people can get. To. And his voice, you know, just resonated this high C note.
Mm.
People said it was out. You know, it was a gift from God.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. So what Jesus is saying here is that when we let his divine will operate in us to bring everything into harmony, that's what makes that person very attractive to anybody. It's just to see the sheer harmony in that person's life, okay? And he says that in heaven they hear it as a note belonging to his harmonies. Each one of us is a little musical note. I think it's fascinating, you know. But everything in heaven is in order and is harmony. I just want to give you a few references for Make Music for the Lord. Make Music for the Lord. Psalm 49:4. Psalm 146, the whole lot of it. 46. 147, 148, 149, and 150. The last five Psalms in the Psalter are just pure music, praise and glory to the Lord. Okay. So all this coming into divine harmony is us becoming another Christ. Okay. So Jesus continues. As she goes along doing even the smallest actions, she makes a melody for me. And as I hear it, I immediately recognize that it is music because it's in the right place at the right time, at the right level, that everything is right about it. That the soul has taken from my will, that is from my temperament, and I run to listen to it. And I like it so much that I am very pleased and cheered from all the wrongs that others do to me. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So he said, my daughter, what will happen when these little melodies pass into heaven? Because he says everything done in his will lasts forever. I will put the soul in front of me, he said. I will play the music and she'll play her own. And we will dart through each other. Now, my image of that is of a parent and a small child playing the same instrument at different levels. But that the child has learned to put in a few notes in harmony with the adult. And the adult has learned how to play around the child. Am I talking English?
Yeah.
That's what I think it is. That our little note was put in with his. I will play the music and she'll play her own. We will dart through each other. The sound of one will be the echo of the sound of the other. The harmonies will mix together. In clear notes, it will be known to all the blessed that this soul is nothing other than the fruit of my will, the portent of my will. Now, portent is really a prodigy, a miracle. And all of heaven will enjoy one more paradise. Now, the paradise is the soul in union with the divine will. These are the souls to whom I keep repeating, had I not created the heavens for you alone, I would create them. Now, that actually is something that if you're needing a bit of encouragement, you need to take it off the page and write it onto something that you can pick up, stick it onto your desk or something. That for someone who'd live in the divine will, Jesus said if he hadn't made the heavens, he'd go and do it for you. Isn't that amazing? In them, I lay the heaven of my will, and I will make of them the true images of myself. That's Romans 8:29. Now, let me give you the words that the church uses for true image. Vero, icon. V-E-R-O is true, and I-C-O-N is image. That's why there's a certain lady called Veronica. But Veronica wasn't her name. Her name was Nike. And because Jesus left his true image on her cloth on his way to Calvary, she's only ever remembered as Veronica, the true image of Christ. So Vero icon, he wants to make each one of us an image. That's very interesting that somebody looking at you would be reminded of Christ. Now, that's a very, very powerful way of drawing souls to God. Very powerful. And in fact, I think it's more powerful than words, that they're actually just drawn. I will make them true images of myself. And within these heavens, I keep wandering about, enjoying myself and playing with them. Now, these heavens is us, the heavens of the divine will. Okay, and I think that should be a small h because it's us. I keep wandering about, enjoying myself and playing with them. That's Proverbs 8:31. To these heavens, and I think again that should be a small h. I repeat, had I not left myself in the Holy Sacrament of the Eucharist for you alone, I would have done it. So that's Romans 8:19, that the whole of creation is waiting for these people to show themselves. In fact, they are my true hosts. And just as I could not live without a will, in the same way, I cannot live without these heavens of my will, small h. I don't blame the typist for getting confused. I cannot live without these heavens of my will. So put a little note there in the margin and say, that's us. Because you might get confused the next time you read it. Rather, they are my true hosts, but my Calvary... And they're not only my true hosts, but my Calvary and my very life. These heavens of my will, small h, are more dear to me and more privileged than the tabernacles and the very consecrated hosts in them. Because in the host, my life ends as the species is consumed, while in these heavens, small h, of my will, my life never ends. Even more, they serve as my hosts on the earth and will be my eternal hosts in heaven. These are the living hosts. To these heavens of my will, small h, I add, had I not incarnated myself in the womb of my mother, for these souls alone I would have incarnated myself, and for them I would have suffered my passion. You need to put a big NB beside that. That someone living in his divine will is so precious to him, he would have done it just for them. It's absolutely amazing. Because in them, I find the true fruit of my incarnation and passion. So that's what he thinks of people living in the divine will. Okay. I'm writing a heading for this for myself now, what he has done for us. For us in the divine will. Okay. So let's come to March the 8th. The state of victim of Jesus during his hidden life. This morning, Father G, this is very, very, very interesting, offered himself as a victim to our Lord. This Father G, if you remember back to volumes 7 and 8, was the priest who decided to respond to the invitation to put the priests into the reunions. Do you remember the reunions?
Yes.
And Father G was the one who decided, and now he's offered himself as a victim, which is very, very interesting. He's offered himself as a victim to our Lord, and I was praying, offering him and asked the Lord to accept him. Then Jesus said, "My daughter, I accept him wholeheartedly." Imagine a priest offering himself. It's very special. It was extremely special that Padre Pio was a victim soul in the 20th century. "Tell him that his life will no longer be his." That's Galatians 2:20. "It will be mine, and that I choose him as a victim of my hidden life." Now, this is the first time I've come across this. I haven't come across this anywhere else. I've heard St. Therese offered herself as a victim to divine love, Louisa to divine justice. I think Padre Pio was to divine justice. But I've never heard anybody offering themselves as a victim to the hidden life. Okay, this is very special. "My hidden life was that of a victim for the whole interior life of man. So it satisfied for the bad thoughts, desires, tendencies and affections. Everything that man does externally is nothing other than the outpouring of his interior." That's Mark 7:21. Mark 7:21 and Jeremiah 17:9-10. Now, in Mark 7:21, Jesus says, it's not something that goes into you that spoils you. It's what comes out of you. And he gives a big, long list of sins. So it's the outpouring of his interior. If so much evil shows on the outside, what must the interior be like? Now, beside that, I want you to put Matthew 23. That's where Jesus, in the end, told the scribes and Pharisees what he saw was on their inside. Therefore, 23. The whole chapter, Matthew 23. It's the whole chapter. So if so much evil is shown on the outside, what must the interior be like? Therefore, the redoing of the interior of man cost me very much. This is extremely important because it's in the hidden life that Jesus dedicated his whole being to redoing us. Therefore, the redoing of the interior of man cost me very much. It's enough to say that it took me as long as 30 years. So put a big heading up here, redoing human nature. Redoing human nature. So if you ever need the title, you'll find it again. Now, my thought, my heartbeat, breath and desire were always intent on running close to the thought, the heartbeat, the breath and desire of man in order to repair them, to satisfy for them and to sanctify them. So I chose Father G as a victim for this point of my hidden life. And I want all of his interior united with me. And I want it offered to me to satisfy me for the evil interior of other souls. I choose him for this on purpose because, being a priest, he knows better than others what the interior of souls is like. Why is that? Because he hears confessions.
Yeah.
Okay. He knows the rot and the slime that is actually in them. From this, he can better know how much my state of victim cost me, a state in which I want him to take part. And not only him, but others as well, whom he will approach. Notice that, that he's to go to other priests and ask other priests to make this reparation. Now, if priests would make reparation like this, the church would come on, the ship would steady very, very quickly, because their position is very powerful. So he said, my daughter, tell the priest that I am giving him a great grace by accepting him as a victim soul, because becoming a victim soul is nothing other than a second baptism. That really needs to be underlined. That means the old life stops and a completely new life starts. Or rather, it's more than a baptism, because it is about rising again in my very life. So it means that the old life is dead and he rises to a completely new life in Christ. And since the victim soul must live with me and from me, it is necessary for me to wash him of every stain, giving him a new baptism, strengthening him in grace to be able to admit him to live with me. In other words, being a victim soul requires a person to have arrived at union with God. Someone at a lesser stage has far too much purification to go through. Therefore, from now on, in anything the priest does, he will no longer say that it is his own, but that it is mine. So, whether he prays, speaks, or works, he will say that these are my things. So after this, Jesus seemed to be looking around, and I said, Lord, what are you looking at? Aren't we alone? He said, no, there are other people here. I draw them around you, he said, to have them closer to me. I think that's a huge statement. So Jesus is saying, he's speaking to her on a spiritual level now, that he draws souls closer to Louisa to have them closer to him. If you draw people close to a fire, you'll warm them. Okay. And Louisa said, do you love them? Imagine asking the Lord, does he love anybody? He said, yes, but I'd like them to be more at ease, more trusting, more brave, and more intimate with me, with no thought about themselves. They must know that victims are no longer the masters of themselves, otherwise they would annul the state of victim. Now, there's something else there. Jesus has brought all of our souls close to Louisa. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, and I'm talking to each person in the room now, including myself. I want you to be more at ease with me, Jesus is saying. I want you to be more trusting of me. I want you to be more brave. And I want you to be more intimate with me and an awful lot less thought about yourself. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
That is absolutely direct. Okay. So then, having to cough a little, Louisa said, Jesus, let me come soon. Let me die of consumption. Now, consumption was the thing in 1912. There was a huge TB problem. Actually, St. Therese of Lisieux died of TB. She said, hurry, she said, let me come, take me with you. And Jesus said, don't make me see you are discontent. It's only 1912, and she's to go as far as 1947, as far as I know. Yes, you will die of consumption, just a little longer, he said. But if you don't die of corporal consumption, in other words, he's saying you got the wrong illness, she actually died of pneumonia, you will die of the consumption of love, which is a different subject. Oh, please, do not go out of my will. Notice how she's still free. She's free, she's free, she's free. Don't go out of my will, for my will be your paradise. Or better still, the paradise of my will. Watch this now. I think this is unbelievable. For as many days that you will be on the earth, so many paradises will give you in heaven. Now, I did a little bit of mathematics on this. There's 365 days in the year. You multiply it by 82. Okay? And you get 29,930 paradises that she got.
Yes. Didn't she do well?
She did pretty well.